Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for This Week in Google is provided by CacheFly. CacheFly.com. This is TWiG, This Week in Google, Episode 5 for August 29th, 2009, Ice Cream in the Clouds. This show is brought to you by listeners like you and your contributions. We couldn't do it without you. Thanks so much. This is TWiG, This Week in Google. Well, really, it's This Week in Google, the cloud, and anything else we feel like talking about. Jeff Jarvis has the week off, spending time with his family. How dare he? But Gina Trapani is here, as always. Gina, great to have you back.
Great to be on the show. Good afternoon.
Smarterware.org, founder of Lifehacker, author of Twitalytics. That's going to be your new credit. Author of... I try to install it, and I have some questions for you.
Uh-oh. Yes, let's talk.
You didn't mean to support it, did you? You just thought he'd write it and throw it out there. But replacing Jeff Jarvis on the show this week, a guy who certainly knows a lot about the cloud, Doug Kay of the Conversations Network. Hi, Doug.
Hi, I have my head in the cloud.
Doug's been doing cloud for a long time. In fact, you have a business, don't you? A cloud business of some kind? No.
Not any longer. No. I did some software development using... Amazon Web Services Cloud.
You have experience using EC2.
I sold it. Sold that business. Yeah.
What a smart man. Yeah. Doug's best known for being a proto podcaster with the Conversations Network and IT Conversations. And he's really been keeping the conversation alive for 6 years now, 7 years, 8 years. When did you start the Conversations Network?
2003.
Wow. That's great. And we have a new person. This is going to be, I think, the way we're going to do this show. I love doing this, where we have Jeff and Gina and me, and then we rotate in a fourth. And there's so many wonderful voices in the community out there. I was very pleased. I got a DM on Twitter over the week from Mary Hodder, who said, "How do I get on that show?" Mary is very well known in the community. It turns out knows Jeff very well, knows Gina very well, knows Doug. Everybody knows Mary Hodder from Napsterization.org, an entrepreneur, an expert in user experience. And what else? What other credit can I give you, Mary?
Well, I'm the founder of Dabble, which was a video search service that I started about 4 or 5 years ago. And then I'm starting a new company, actually. It's called Wellness Mobile. So what we're doing is building mobile applications for to help people monitor their own health. And this started because I was working at a mobile company for the last year, building products for them. And in the meantime, I got an Android, when they first came out last October. And one of the effects of having a startup, especially one that you work incredibly hard in and never take any breaks, is that you gain a little bit of weight, which I did. And I was sort of horrified because I've never been overweight like this. And what am I going to do, right? Of course, I turn to my mobile phone and I start downloading apps. And I realize how horrifying they all are. They're just punitive and awful. And I thought, I can fix this. So we're building something that's really fun and really motivating and totally different than what anybody else has got out there. So I'm actually having a blast doing it. And mobile stuff is actually great. It's really fun.
So you are also you're a developer as much as you are an entrepreneur.
Well, I'm not a coder. I'm
you don't
not
code?
No, I have coded and it's scary. I'm a usability engineer and I write search algorithms and I do data stuff, XML and that kind of thing. But I don't consider myself a coder. I think that's like a whole nother level of technical understanding and ability that I have not mastered.
And as you know, the worst thing about coding is you have to support your users.
Well, that is true.
Look at that look from Gina.
I'm not a coder either. I just kind of play one on twit.tv.
Yeah, I wouldn't claim being a coder. Doug, you're a coder. You're a coder, Doug, right? You code?
About 60 or 70 hours a week, yeah.
That's a coder.
Yeah.
Wow.
I took 20 years off to run a company, and I spent the last 10 back in coding, so...
Is it kind of nice to be back doing that?
Oh, it's great. I love it.
So, you know, the Google, it's funny, the Google took a little time off this week, not a huge bunch of new stuff after a flood of new stuff over the last 6 months. But Apple filled in the gap with this snow leopard thing. It's a very pretty cover.
Sleopard.
I call it Snow Job.
I like that.
I think this.
That's great,
Gina. You had the same experience I did. In fact, I've started to talk to people. Despite the good reviews, and it got a lot of good reviews in all the big, you know, magazines and newspapers, and everybody said, "Oh, great new." My experience of it was okay. I just installed Leopard.
Yep, a better Leopard. A Leopard. What Leopard should have been?
A little better. Not better like Windows 7 is better than Vista. A little better.
Cheaper for those who didn't upgrade from Leopard.
Yeah, $30. So that's good. And by the way, even though Apple says you have to upgrade from Leopard or buy a full package, this works just fine even on an empty hard drive. It doesn't ask you for a serial number or anything.
No, it doesn't.
So, yeah, this could be the upgrade from anything as long as you have an Intel Mac.
Yeah.
I think it's significant because they abandoned PowerPC. Finally.
Mm-hmm. Well, my family pack is sitting here on the desk, and I've still got a couple of rumored incompatibilities. That's why I'm holding off.
That's what I'm thinking, is nobody should rush to this because of the incompatibilities.
So what did maybe Gina knows the answer to this. What did they change that would cause these incompatibilities?
I think the official word was that the software that doesn't work with Snow Leopard, the developers had used, you know, methods that they shouldn't have, or had you know, integrated with the operating system in ways that they shouldn't have. And the incompatibility list isn't too bad. It's mostly old stuff. I don't think there's anything really major that's a new version. I've been running the Snow Leopard dev preview for months and months, and didn't run into any problems. Though I should qualify that by saying, you know, I'm not a designer, and I'm not, you know, I don't edit video and that kind of thing. So maybe I'm not a good example, but I don't think the incompatibilities were too much of an issue. Have any of you, Leo, have you run into any trouble?
Yeah, a little few menu, like I have a menu calendar that stopped doing what it was supposed to do. And probably you're exactly right, because they used some call that was either deprecated or never even revealed.
Exactly.
And and Apple's always having to do that, telling people, don't use these, you know, we have an API for a reason.
Right.
But a lot of people, you know, hacksies and that kind of thing, they're trying to get around the little kinks in the operating system. So they use, I have two family packs, Doug. I bought, because I have enough Macs, I thought, well,
I missed you.
Two family packs, one for here and one for the other family. But I have to say, for under $100, I've upgraded 10 Macs. So it's not expensive. Gina, you were saying it's just exactly the right price.
It is just exactly the right price. And, you know, I wrote a post on my blog basically saying, you know, I think Snow Leopard is a service pack, which is exactly what,
that's,
you know,
what
David
I've
Pope
been saying.
Said that, like, haters were going to say, and that was an uninformed wisecrack. And I'm sorry to come off ungrateful. I'm generally not this, like, entitled and self-righteous. But, the reviews, which were very good, and I agree with, because I've been running it, and it's better, it's smaller, it's faster, and those things are all great. The reviews were just a little more gushy than I, you know, think that it really deserved. I mean, it you know, $30 isn't such a good deal. It's exactly the right price. I said in my post, if they had charged for more than $30, it would have been robbery. And right now I just kind of feel like a little nickeled and dimed, but you know, it was worth it. It was very worth it. But you know, really, to the end user, to people who don't understand how operating systems work, which is 99% of the population, this isn't that big a deal. I mean,
no.
It does
in fact, if you put two computers side by side, Leopard, Snow Leopard, there's no difference.
Right. And, you know, the things that I love about Snow Leopard, I mean, for example, if a file is in use and you try to eject the disk that the file's on, now Snow Leopard tells you what process is locking the file. That's great. But like, is that something I'm going to be like really excited about? I mean, isn't that something an operating system should do? I mean, Windows doesn't. I'm not sure actually if 7 does or Vista does. But like, really? Like, am I going to get like excited about that?
No.
Like, thanks for doing the thing that I
you should have done. Letting me eject disks more.
Right. Thanks for letting me eject the disk I want to eject and give me information about why you're not letting me do that.
Isn't that great? Now, the reason we bring this up in a cloud show is this is the opposite. This is the old school. This is a operating system that comes on a disk and then you install and you upgrade. This, I think we're rapidly coming to the time when this is not going to happen. You're just not going to get a CD with a full blown operating system on it. I look at the pain people are going through with clean installs. There is no upgrade on this. You have to do a archive and install. And where is my plug-in? Where is this? Where is that? This seems so antiquated.
Yeah, it seemed crazy that I went to a store and bought a DVD and then came home.
It's crazy.
You know, I did the wipe and install thing, which, you know, most people just did the upgrade, but it was kind of crazy. I was like, why aren't I downloading this again? Why wasn't this a patch? I mean, I don't know. People said that it was such a big rewrite of the underlying code that pushing it through software update was a little too unreasonable an expectation. And fine, like I'll give them that. But the whole go to the store and purchase the DVD thing or have it shipped to me in a truck, you know, using gas, it just seemed insane.
Well, maybe the whole idea of an operating system in general is kind of, this kind of antiquated idea. Maybe what we really need is something, a thin client that just has a good browser in it.
Yeah, you know, I was thinking about this, like in terms of cloud computing, it really brings up the question is like, how much does the desktop operating system really matter? So, I mean, I've been using a Mac and PC side by side for years. I mean, ever since I started doing serious sort of tech blogging, I had to be conversant in both operating systems. And I rebuilt my Mac a few times during the process of the Snow Leopard coverage, just to do the coverage. And basically, once I had Firefox installed and Xmarks, which is where I store all my bookmarks and keywords, like I was 75% to a fully working computer, you know, on any computer, that is, like any brand new machine. Once I have Firefox,
isn't that kind of interesting?
Yeah, I'm 75% there. I mean, you know, sure, I have to, you know, move my data and install. I have favorite text editors, and I like Quicksilver and those kind of things. But really, it's about the browser. So it's interesting to me. Same kind of thing when Windows 7 comes up.
I mean, that's exactly why I've been a converted to Mac user for, let's say, the last 5 or 6 years, having come from Windows like everyone else. But I wanted to start traveling with a netbook. So I get the netbook. It's got the browser. What else do I need?
Right.
I pretty much have everything. Passwords were the only thing because I use 1Password. But
is Chrome going to be like that? Is Chrome really just Chrome the OS, not the Chrome the browser. Is Google's OS going to basically be Chrome?
Well, that's the hope, isn't it?
Yeah, that's the hope. I mean, Chrome is building into the dev builds do include bookmark syncing.
Right.
Yeah, bookmark syncing right now. So, I mean, I wonder if Chrome, I was thinking about with Android, you know, when you set up your Android phone, the first thing you do is sign in with your Google account, right? You can't run the phone without signing in first. So I wonder if, you know, Chrome's going to do the same thing, just sync down all your data, your bookmarks, maybe even, frighteningly enough, passwords. I mean, Xmarks does store passwords as well, so I wouldn't be surprised if Chrome did that. And then you just go from there.
I love installing Xmarks and just, I'm done. As you say, I've got the passwords, Firefox, passwords, bookmarks. It's like I'm home.
Yeah, exactly.
When we first started talking about Google as being a serious competitor to Microsoft, I don't think we really understood what that meant. I mean, we saw things like Google Docs. Does it mean they're just going to compete with Microsoft Office? But I think with something like this, we're starting to see what the flavor of Google's ultimate competition to Microsoft, or to say their challenge to Microsoft, is ultimately going to actually look like. Because they're moving in that direction, but we don't really talk about it in those terms.
It's not going to be a head-on challenge.
No, I mean they're gonna change the game.
Yeah.
Rather than they're not gonna
can Microsoft using Microsoft rules. Microsoft's certainly saying, okay, we get it. Can they compete? Is Azure and the new Microsoft Office that's in the cloud? Can Microsoft put together something that's competitive with whatever this new thing is?
They've never done it before. I mean, everything they've done in that vein has always come after the fact. I mean, they've always, you know, come in later than their competition and sort of, you know, push their way into the marketplace. So they're certainly not going to be the leaders of this.
Right. Mary, we have been talking around you. Do you have anything you want to throw in here? But I should tell you, if you're ever on a Twitch show, that the normal bounds of decency are all gone. Just interrupt the hell out of us.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
Can I even swear?
Yeah, just jump right in.
Don't swear.
I'm just kidding. I just wanted to
know.
You know
why we don't swear? Because we have kids listening, but we can interrupt each other because kids don't do that anymore.
Right. No, I actually have been paying attention to the Chrome thing, but I haven't really made up my mind about what I think about it, you know, the Chrome OS issue.
Right.
I think it's a really interesting thing. I think Android actually, and at least for me right now, has had a much bigger impact on the marketplace than the Chrome OS idea. I mean, the interesting thing about Google is when they make an announcement, they can ice a market and they can change a market. I mean, they're like Microsoft.
Used to be. Microsoft could do that. That's right.
Microsoft could do it 10 years ago, and now Google does it, right?
Yep.
So pre-announcing
Chrome like that really did get a lot of attention, even though it's a year off.
It's huge. Yeah, exactly. In this case, I think they actually will build it. I know instances where they've announced things and then never done anything. Certainly for us in Dabble, you know, in January 06, they announced that they were going to build video search, and it took everyone 2 years to realize they were never going to build video search. They can't. And so I always take what they announce sort of with a big grain of salt, but at the same time, I am really interested in whatever, you know, what sort of impacts that's going to have. I think that the Android thing, I'm actually looking down at my G2.
Oh, you're a G2 user. Oh.
Yes. Oh my God. I love this phone. So I promptly got rid of my two G1s and started using this. And I think Android is amazing. And we've already written a couple of like four programs for it. And it's great. I mean, it's missing some stuff that is really necessary, but you know, so what? It's going to be built in. It'll be added. You know, it's
Mary. Are you developing for that platform because it's better, it's easier, or because it's open?
Both, actually. I think it's. I do think that it's better, but I also think that someone just wrote on the IRC that Android needs better hardware designs. So there's 18 phones coming by the end of the year.
Wow.
And yeah, I mean, really, like, we're not even 1 year into Android, and they've already sold, I think the June figure was 12 million phones. I mean, that was 8 months after the G1 came out. I mean, it's going faster than the iPhone, because the iPhone paved the way for a big marketplace.
It's pretty good for what is essentially a crappy handset. I mean, that's pretty good.
Well, the G1 was, but the G2 rocks. Yeah. I mean, it's really great.
Yeah.
But I also love the fact that when we make a version of, you know, some app, that we can throw it up and people start downloading it. And, you know, I mean, Ed is coding Wellness Mobile, and he did a thing called RPN Calc. So he made an RPN calculator, and he made several versions of it. He did like a science version and a regular old RPN calc, and then he did a financial calculator. And he's selling the financial one, but the other ones, you know, he just put them out, and 20,000 people downloaded them and continue to use them. And, you know, that's great. Nobody, you know, Steve Jobs did not have to have his feet kissed by us. I mean, we just put it out there, and it's cool. And so
this makes me think of something that I put on Twitter earlier in the week that got a lot of reaction, which is amazing since nobody listens to me on Twitter. I put up something where I just said, mobile apps are the new content. And I got a lot of flack on it, but let me explain what I was thinking about there. The whole idea that sort of the impulse buy of the app, which, you know, used to be the ringtone, it's the MP3. And, you know, when you now go to somebody with an iPhone or an Android phone, you know, you're just as likely to say, hey, you know, try this free app or try this 99-cent app as you were a few years ago to say, listen to a song.
100% agree. In fact, I can back you up. My son just had his 15th birthday. Last year, he got credits towards songs. This year, he got a $15 App Store credit. Mm-hmm. And it kind of blew me away. I realized it's exactly as you say. That's the new content.
The mobile app is the new content. And it's also the fact that if you're a publisher, you are now tending to wrap any content you have into the form of an application. You know, look at the public radio apps or any of the print journals or anything. You don't deliver content to a raw phone. You wrap it in an application, which is somewhat of a new paradigm, at least.
It's interesting, though. There's a continuum where you can put content out on the web. You can do m.twitter.com, and people can go to that you know, page through the browser in their phone, and you don't really need to wrap it in anything in order to get it out to people. And then there's, you know, going to the opposite end where the entire application sits on its own. It doesn't access any data at all from the outside world. And then there's all the stuff in between. And, you know, I actually think that in the future, we will build apps where it's really just wrapping around web pages so that you can grab whatever you need. But right now, things are so slow and it's so inconsistent in terms of pushing that content out into the little wrapper that you might have on the phone application, that it really is just a much nicer user experience to have most of the stuff in the application.
It's also very retro, though, because after all, isn't that a lot of the progress that the web brought us was that before the web, everything was an app. And the web said, right, here's one app to rule them all. And here's RSS. Right. And now you could do everything in one app. And we're now completely reversing it. And I have to admit, as a content creator, I would really actually really like the idea of having one app on a mobile device. That's me. Well, press that button, you get all our shows.
Well, not just that, Leo, but it's not, you know, you don't want just a web-based thing that comes into the phone as a bookmark. What you want is, you want to use a 20th century term, you want the real estate.
Right.
You want an icon on that phone that's going to be there forever. That's the big
thing. That's what we're doing, but is that good for users? I mean, it's good for content creators.
Yeah, it's fine.
Is that what users want?
Sure, you can store hundreds of apps on your phone. You might as well, they're more convenient than putting a bookmark in a mobile browser.
That's one thing I didn't like about the Google phone, was I only had, have they increased this, but I only had 3 pages of apps.
Yeah, you can. I've got way more than 3 pages of apps.
With the iPhone, I have 12 now, and even that, they're almost all full.
Wow.
I buy apps like candy.
Yeah.
But speaking of mobile apps.
I don't know what the apps are.
Yeah. No, go ahead, Mary.
I don't know how many. Do you want me to show you this?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Here it is.
So here's the G2.
So here it is.
Yeah.
And actually what you're seeing right now is St. Louis, Missouri, from a webcam where,
the desktop's live.
Yeah, the desktop's live. Wow. And basically every 30 minutes, the application, it's called World Apps, goes out and grabs a screenshot from some webcam somewhere. So it totally makes you want to travel because it's like Paris and Rome and St. Louis and Tokyo and, you know, a gorgeous lake somewhere in Oregon, you know, whatever. And basically it's constantly changing the background. So that's my favorite app.
Love
actually
that.
On
yeah.
this.
That's really cool.
I totally recommend it. It used to be called La Tour Eiffel because they just had the Eiffel Tower webcam. So this is the, I'm going to try to do it. It went away. It's really hard to do this pointing it at the camera.
Upside down and backwards.
Upside down and backwards,
like,
exactly.
Like Ginger Rogers. No, she wasn't upside down. She was just in heels.
So let's see if I can get this thing. And plus, putting it at the right distance in the camera, it's like really,
normally you slide it left to right. You're sliding up. Oh.
Yeah, so see, I have all these different
goodness.
Apps in there.
Now, is that something you added as a third-party application? Or
no, that's just the built-in menu. Yeah, that's just the built-in menu.
Okay. It's not desktop screens. You pulled up the menu. I got it. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
So, I mean, I could do it sideways if I did it this way. But, I mean, the point is that, you know, it's, in other words, I keep downloading apps and I have no indication that I'm ever going to hit a limit. I think it's just the amount of memory in the phone.
Yeah, it's the amount of memory. Like, I downloaded Listen, which Leo talked about last week, and I downloaded a couple of podcasts and immediately ran out of space because it was, because it was downloading MP3s and I had filled it up with music already. But that's a limitation of the handset. That's not Android.
Obviously, Mary, you've seen some of these. You probably can't talk about all of them. Motorola's going to have new handsets.
Yeah.
Who else? What do you like? Is there one that we
Motorola
should look for?
Motorola and Samsung are the main ones that I know of that are developing Android-based apps for the.
How about
this fall?
And Android on larger platforms, non-phone platforms.
Are we going to see? Ooh.
I think it's a really interesting idea, but I don't know anybody who's doing it yet.
I thought it was odd that Google would announce Chrome OS when it really has an OS.
I did too.
The here's the deal with this, like. the mobile world, at least the way that I see it. So, you know, so Ed, who's coding for this for me, is a Linux kernel engineer, which is very old school, right? That used to be like the top of the heap of the geek pyramid, right? And the geek food pyramid that was like right at the very top. You know, and really that kind of coding for a long time, I think with the web has sort of fallen out of fashion. It's like very mundane and boring and whatever. But with mobile stuff, it comes very much back into vogue because even if you're not actually coding Linux, he happens to be a Linux kernel engineer, was at Google, now he's at Palm. That kind of coding is very in sync with what you need to do on a mobile phone. So just general app development, you know, there's a lot of similarity.
Yeah.
The other thing that's interesting for me about this OS is that it really is a mini version of what you have in terms of running Linux on a server or whatever. It's just missing certain pieces, but it's Linux. I mean, it's easy to plug those things in or build little pieces or little sort of mini parts, need to be stuck in.
Right.
I mean, I don't know how else to describe it. Modules, whatever it is. Yeah. But it's a really interesting, I think it's a really interesting platform. And I think it's super cool that it's open and the fact that, you know, they have a few rules and you just follow the rules and you put your app up and that's it. And, you know, that for me is just huge over iPhone. I think in the long run, it's going to be much more successful than an iPhone kind of style thing where it's very closed and controlled.
Well, as it happens, Phil Jackson agrees with you. Is Whoopi Goldberg. Did you see the new T-Mobile ad?
Well, if you want to sing out, sing out. And if you want to be
good commercial.
There's Whoopi. And Cat Stevens, I might add.
To be. You know that there
there's
are.
Phil Jackson.
And if you want
who's
to
that?
Be
I don't know who that is.
Me.
Jesse, somebody.
And if you want to be you, be you.
T-Mobile presents there's the first phone that becomes 100% you. The new MyTouch 3G with Google, only from T-Mobile.
Is that the first? That's the first I've seen G1 ad, or a Google phone ad.
That yeah, and that's an
makes
interesting
me want
marketing.
One. Makes me want
yeah,
one. It's so
yeah,
warm.
And it's an interesting marketing tactic like that. This, you know, the first phone that can really be you, like that app that Mary just showed.
She's
where the
waving her
changes.
Phone.
Mary's waving her phone from the camera, which I love. And that's not something that you could do on an iPhone that's not jailbroken.
Yes.
Yeah.
Right. Right.
Good
you can
point.
Customize the phone in ways that you can't, you know, with the iPhone. And this is the sell. This is the thing. This is what Google has to sell.
That was
Android.
Subtle. That was a little subtle, but that was a zing, wasn't it?
Yeah, definitely.
Yes.
You know, John Gruber wrote that great piece, which burned me to death because I wish that I had written it. The Android opportunity, which I should have bookmarked it. But he wrote this great post, and he's totally, you know, he's the Apple guy. He wrote this great post about the way that Google needs to market Android. And one of the things that he said is, you know, that marketing 101, they have to emphasize the things that you can do with the Android phone you can't with the iPhone. And one of those things is just like setting your freaking wallpaper to what you want it to be or, from, you know, webcams from around the world. I mean, how cool is that? And that's really what that commercial is showing. I couldn't tell what app they're using, but like when Whoopi brings up that cartoon image of herself and someone else, I mean, that looks like a wallpaper to me. So, God, I hope they can do it. I hope they can get a decent handset out there, and I hope that they can emphasize, you know, the things that you can do with Android that the iPhone can't do. And what Gruber said that I really like, too, is that kind of marketing tack will get the power users and the savvy folks, and that's fine.
That
you know?
Gets the iPhone
that
users going,
That would get us, and that doesn't have to be the entire iPhone market, but you just have to kind of win the hearts of the leaders in tech. And right now, you know, it's you know, we have like Mary and me, but you know, there are a lot of people who tried out Android and said this sucks. So
I did.
Do it better.
And it was battery life, it was memory, it was those things that you already talked about. But that was the G1, which wasn't a great piece of hardware.
The G1 sucked.
It was terrible.
The form factor was awful.
Yeah.
But the improvements in the OS and the improvements in this phone, the form factor here, oh my God, I love this phone.
Now, have you played with the Tour yet? Because that ad was for the Tour.
No.
That's the newest one.
Well, this phone was given to us at the Google I.O.
That's the G2 one. Yeah.
Yeah, can you see it on the back?
Yeah.
See,
oh, look, it says Google I.O. and everything. Oh, shut up.
Yeah, that's cool.
And you got that means you got a wave invite, too. You got the two most valuable things of the year.
I do have a Wave invite.
The best swag of the year.
Yeah.
We played with Wave a little bit, and to be totally honest, I wasn't that excited. I didn't care. What can I say? You know, here's the deal. We started playing with the Google App Engine because we made this April Fool's app. It was called Personal Hype Quotient, and it's at personalhypequotient.com.
Wait a minute. I got to try my Personal Hype Quotient.
And frankly, we haven't updated it. So if you go to our quote-unquote advisors page, which is completely bogus, you'll see a list of people, but some of the icons don't resolve, and it's because they've changed them on Twitter, and we pulled them from Twitter. But basically, we hacked this together in like 2 days, and what it does is you stick in your Twitter credentials, you say, yes, give me my personal hype quotient, and then you get rated, and it's from 0 to 10, and basically we did it as a joke, you know, because people are hypey on Twitter, and
I can only imagine what mine's gonna be.
Well, put it in and check it out.
I'm proud to say you're using OAuth, so I didn't have to.
We used OAuth.
Very good.
Yes, we used
OAuth.
We were one of the very first apps to use OAuth because it was literally right at April 1st when they made that switch. So we bumped into every horror in the in the book.
On a scale of 0 to 10.
Yes.
I am level 7 founder promoter.
Yay!
Which either means I've got VC dollars riding on my own hype, or I'm running a conference, or both.
I'm running mine right now. It's redirecting me.
So
I'm
this excited. Is not this is actually not a made up number. This you do have an algorithm. It's not.
We actually have a little algorithm, yeah. And so basically we took the algorithm. We explain it down in our FAQ about how we did that. Basically, we took your last whatever number of tweets. We figured out how many times you linked to yourself, and we used 5 APIs. We used the Google Open Social API to figure out what URLs you were associated with, even if they didn't have your name in them or anything.
Well, wait a minute now. I didn't link to myself. It says you self-linked in 0. You retweeted in 20 of the last 540 tweets, but I hyped in 13. What's hype mean? Okay, how do you measure
hyping,
hype?
Hyping means that you use any of certain words.
And exclamation marks.
No. Actually, we could use exclamation marks, but no. It's more about, do you say, you know, I'm doing this,
cool.
You do something where you're like, I'm cool, then we would take the I'm cool statement or, for example, if you retweet and you retweet somebody else who's then promoting you.
Yeah, I don't do that.
And you leave your name in there, your Twitter handle.
Yeah, that's bad.
Yeah, that's kind of bad Twitter etiquette. Yeah. Then we give you a hype point.
I think I get hype points because I have so many followers. I don't think I did. I didn't do many.
Yeah, it's partly based on your number of followers.
I think that's mostly what it is. Because look, I only hyped 13 out of 540, 20 retweets, 0 self-links. I think I'm pretty cool, man. Did you get a
5? Well,
you got a 5?
I did. I'm level 5. My website needs hits, okay? So get on board the me train. I love the coffee. The coffee alone is awesome.
It's really good, Mary. I love
it. I'm still waiting for it to come back from OAuth.
Yeah, that's the Twitter
sure
OAuth.
Everybody and their brother who's watching is doing
that's
this right
why.
Now.
That's why. We probably broke Twitter now.
Or the APIs.
Yeah.
Well, so basically, that was my first experience playing with the Twitter APIs, the Google Open Social,
is Open stuff. Social to work with?
It's actually very easy. I really, really liked it.
I'm hopeful for Open Social. I really am.
It actually has this really cool thing where it figures out who are you socially related to, and then it says, okay, these are your relationships. And then what you can do is, in our instance, because we were trying to figure out, are you tweeting about yourself? Like Guy Kawasaki constantly links to himself, right?
Oh, really?
He links
to himself. He doesn't even do it himself.
I know, he's got other people doing
people
it.
But do
his
that.
Account. Yeah. His account links to Alltop, and Alltop is associated with him, so he gets a really big score.
Right.
He's just under the Armageddon of personal hype.
Right.
I think he's I hype myself, therefore I am. but guess who is the only person who was the Armageddon of personal hype?
Not
it was
Scoble?
Gary V.
Gary
no.
V. Gary V.
Gary V.
Gary V.
Yeah.
Bring the thunder.
I got mine back.
What's yours?
I'm a whopping level 3.
Yeah, you're the least typey.
I don't follow anybody.
Yeah.
No, you're well, it's not who you follow. It's who follow. How many followers do you have? And then how many times do you talk about people following you?
I see.
Oh, that's a bad. Yeah. That's bad.
See, yeah, that's like another socially uncool thing to do.
But I'm stupidly unaware of my social climbing and hyping possibilities.
Mary, I'm not, are you using the URL that the person like puts in their profile as their self link?
Yes, we look at that, but also we take their Twitter name and that URL, and we plug that into Google's Open Social API.
Oh,
and
nice!
Say, what is this person also involved in?
Oh, how interesting!
And then
we use another API where you can look up all the shortened URLs. So there's 50 services that actually shorten URLs.
Right.
Most people use Bitly now because, you know, Twitter has done this thing. But in April, that wasn't totally clear. A lot of people use TinyURL. There were all these different things. So we use another API to back into what are the real URLs. Then we match them with Open Social.
So are you using longurl.org?
That's
a service I'm thinking about for Twitterlytics. Cool, because it covers like 100 different shortened.
So it takes a shortened URL and undoes it.
Yes, cool. And I think their API is actually great as well.
But in order to get the full set of URLs, you had to use Open Social to find this kind of. It's not a social graph. It's
kind of your URL graph.
My me graph.
Right? Yeah. Your me graph. Yeah. Yeah, it's something like that. Anyway.
Cool, Mary. Really that's cool.
Open Social to work and to do well because I think the other competitor is Facebook. And it's really a choice of having Google do it or Facebook do it. And I think frankly, Facebook's coming on strong on this. I think this is really what Facebook wants to do is do Open Social. They want to do social graph stuff. They want you to use their services. And it scares the heck out of me. I took ACLU has a quiz. Have you done this yet on Facebook? It's terrifying. It's on my Facebook. I'll send it around to all of you. But you take the quiz and it's about what a quiz knows about you. And so not only does the quiz have access to all your personal information, and I guess you could understand that. So you take a quiz and there are all these quizzes, you know, what beetle are you? You take this quiz, whoever's doing the quiz, and there's very little validation of these developers, not only has your entire page, but when a friend of yours takes the quiz, they get your page too, because you're linked to them. I don't even understand how that happens. They, at the end of the quiz, look, folks, if you're on Facebook, search for this. It's from the West Coast Division of ACLU. Search for this ACLU quiz and put it on your page and take it. And it shows you, here's what we know as the quiz designer. Here's what we know about you. They know everything. Here's what we know about your friends, and they know everything. They do give you some settings at the end that you can change, but the default settings are wide open. So it terrifies me. Do you think Google is going to be better with that kind of information?
I wonder, you know, the Google Maps traffic overlay crowdsourcing that data that came out this week, they announced this week. So if you have a phone and you're on the freeway and you're inching along, by default, it's you have to opt out of it. By default, it sends that data to them.
From your phone?
Them know, from the phone, yeah. From a GPS-enabled handset. It lets them know how fast you're going, and then it aggregates that data to show the traffic overlay, which is super cool. I mean, this is like, we're living in the future. This is what I thought of when I saw this. Yeah. I was like, this is amazing. But it's opt out, which didn't,
I had
wasn't
a,
so cool.
I had a Dash GPS, which was based on OpenMoko. And, it did this it did the same thing, but only with other members, only people who had Dashes. And it's not giving, Dash had, I guess it knew where you were, but it also, to be able to make this map of green and red and yellow streets based on other people with G1 handsets and how fast they're moving is hugely valuable.
It is. It's incredibly valuable. And, you know, they're saying that they're only taking the data in aggregate, that they scrub your like start and destination point so that they're not tracking where you're going. I mean, this is what they're saying. And okay. Because there are privacy issues. But it freaks me out when these things are opt out. You know, the Facebook stuff too. It freaks me out that stuff's opt out. You have to go into your settings and change it.
Yep.
The default settings are incredibly powerful. People don't change them generally.
That's so true. I mean, default settings, typically, you know, 80% of the people will never even go to the pages that change things. Which
explains why MSN or Bing is still so does so well. It's right. Just automatic.
Right.
The thing, my issue is that Facebook is set up so that, you know, their TOU, their terms of use, and the whole premise of the way their features are built is to collect data on you and then go out and match it across the web. And they actually pay outside companies to collect even more data on you and match it all up. Google, on the other hand, is A, not paying anybody to match any data on you that I know of. And I know the people at those companies, and they've never done any work for Google. So I kind of trust that that's not happening. Google's TOU also on a lot of things, like for latitude, you know, they take your last location, they keep it in the system, and the next time they grab a new location, they delete the old one. And so there are certain things that Google has done to actually try to manage some of your privacy issues and to be a little bit better. I think in Google, it's not so much an issue culturally for the company or for the leaders and the leadership in the company to make things private for you, as it is that they are not necessarily thinking about it all the time. But if EFF or somebody comes along and says, hey, you guys, you know, get it together on Latitude, then they get it together. But on Facebook, you know, Facebook's thing is, look, if you can't get a million people in a group who all protest something, we're not even going to look at the issue. And B, we don't care about EFF. And C, hey, it says right in our TOU that we're grabbing everything we can on you and matching you because this is our business model, even though we still don't know how that's going to work. So it's a very different approach. And I'm far more concerned about Facebook than Google.
Did you happen to hear about read the story about the Canadian government and Facebook?
That's actually what stimulated this.
Because I mean, I've been working with it. This last 2 weeks, I've been going back and forth between implementing OpenID and implementing OAuth, which means my head just hurts because I get them confused. But in the process of talking to the folks at Jan Rain, who are sort of the gurus of OpenID.
The OpenID guys. Yeah.
And I brought up this whole issue of the Canadian government, which has, you know, discovered that Facebook is not at all good about they essentially grant you permission. You grant permission and then you sort of have it forever. It's very hard to retract some of the permissions that you give to Facebook. And as a third party, it's even nastier because there's things in the terms of use that say that we're supposed to do certain things about removing or no longer using their identity information. But in fact, that's not enforced technically. It's a very poor system the way they've got it put together there.
So when you take a quiz on Facebook, what can the quiz see about you? Only your answers. People are trying to chat with me. Only your information that's set is public. Almost everything on your profile, even if you use privacy settings to limit access. And it will show, it shows when you take this quiz, all the stuff it knows. It's pretty dramatic. And of course, there's quizzes like crazy on Facebook. So that's why I would like Google and Open Social to win, because I admit we don't, you know, Google could be evil too. But Facebook clearly is not paying any attention to this at all.
Well, I mean, Facebook Connect in particular, you know, really has some, certainly has flaws for third parties, which is what I've been working on. And that's what Eric Schoenfeld over at TechCrunch really covered this week pretty well.
You know, we gave the Palm Pre a hard time because we found out it was sending GPS data to Palm. And now we find out that the G1 and the G2 are doing the same. Which, Gina, do you have to have an app installed for that to be doing that? Or
actually, I believe that it's all GPS-enabled handsets, iPhones as well. If you're, it's Google Maps.
What? So Google Maps is doing this?
Yeah, but wait, hold on. There's a. It's not for every phone. It's only phones that can collect GPS information. So, for example, my Trio, which is this other phone, can you see it?
Yeah.
It's old. It's funky. It's orange.
It has GPS in it.
No, it doesn't. No. It's okay. A Trio 680. So, for example, if I installed an app that could collect a GPS data, right, which is triangulating between the cell towers.
Right.
Then that data could be transmitted back through, if I have an internet connection, transmitted through the internet. The phone companies will not allow that data to be transmitted back. What Gina's talking about, I think, Gina, if I'm wrong, correct me, but I think what you're saying is for phones like this one, which have both the map program comes installed, which I, to be honest, is, I'll show it to you. So right here on the phone, there's a little maps thing right here. And if I click it, what it's going to do is not only is it going to bring up a map, but it's actually going to pinpoint me on the map using GPS. So it'll take a second. I don't know if you guys can.
Yeah, I do that all the time. Yeah.
Right.
You can see the map and you can see a little dot with
me.
And here I am.
Yeah.
So for phones that do that and use Google Maps, then yes, your location data will be transmitted back, especially, that is especially useful to Google if you're driving, because instead of Google having to go out to either TrafficCast, which charges, or to Caltrans and try to piece together data, they can actually get direct user feedback about how fast you're traveling on streets. The question that I have for Google is, are they treating it the same way that they treat Latitude, which is, hey, we have this personally identifying thing that we know about you, your location and your phone number, right? Because now you've transferred this information to them and they've got that. Are they taking just what's valuable, which is the delta between the last two pings, and tossing the personal information, i.e. your phone number and the fact that you were at that location? Are they getting rid of that so that when, you know, the NSA or somebody comes and subpoenas their stuff, you know, they can say truthfully, hey, we have no idea where Mary Hodder is. You know, we just don't know. And that's what I would like to see them do. They should be doing the same thing that they do with Latitude, which is use the data and discard it.
Yeah, that's what they're saying in the official announcement. So I'm looking at the official announcement on the official Google blog, and it says the iPhone Maps application does not support traffic crowdsourcing.
Oh, okay.
But some phones, such as the T-Mobile MyTouch 3G and the Palm Pre, come with Google Maps and traffic crowdsourcing pre-installed. So, okay. And then they talk about privacy, and they said exactly what Mary just said. We only use anonymous speed and location information to calculate traffic conditions. And only do so when you've enabled location services, their instructions on how to opt out. And it says, when a lot of people are reporting data from the same area, we combine their data together to make it hard to tell one phone from another. The vehicle carrying a phone is anonymous. We don't want anyone to find out where that anonymous vehicle came from or where it went. So we find the start and end points of every trip and permanently delete that data, so even Google ceases to have access to it.
Can I trust that statement?
Well, I think there's not just Google. There's nothing to keep NSA from getting into the data stream before Google makes the decision about what to throw away.
So even if Google says that, it's still going over public networks.
Well, I mean, you know, we all know that NSA is capable of getting into the data, you know, through the fiber if they want to, right? So the fact is that
Through the phone company.
Yeah, I mean, Sprint knows exactly where I am. T-Mobile knows exactly where I am. Through GPS.
With GPS, they know within about 20 feet. So,
right. So if you want location privacy, you shouldn't have a cell phone. And that's the unfortunate truth. The NSA really isn't going to go. I know it sounds very cynical. They're not going to go to Google really to get your location.
They don't need to.
What they're really going to do, they don't need to.
They already have
They've
friends.
Already got boxes pre-installed at AT&T, exactly. T-Mobile, QWest. Any, you know, Verizon, they have that.
Right.
So it's, you know, you got to basically turn off the pings to the cell network to really have location privacy.
So we might as well just suck it up, say we've got no privacy, and gosh, now I know how bad the traffic's going to be.
Well, for me, the traffic thing wasn't scary. For me, the thing is not so much the government, because I know they've got that data, right? For me, the issue is someone who I don't really want to know my location getting access.
A stalker. Like
a stalker or maybe my neighbor down the street who really wants to hang out with me and I'm not that crazy about hanging out with them or something. You know, and if they show up at the restaurant where I'm already having drinks with friends, it's awkward. You know what I mean? So I'd rather not have the whole world have it in terms of publicly broadcasting it. But it's, you know... I think we will spend the next few years getting comfortable with the idea that, that having a cell phone means not having complete location privacy. And then we'll figure out where those lines are about, you know, who else can have access to that besides the government and the phone company.
Yeah. Wow.
So.
I don't know whether to be depressed or elated or enervated. I should say, screw it. I'm going to go take a nap. So really, all that upset about Palm, I mean, I was very vocal about, oh man, Palm, you know, been collecting this information, didn't tell us. That's shocking. It really was naive of me. Everybody
knows it's okay to be naive. Sometimes it's nice. It's cute.
It's cute. Oh, isn't he cute? He still thinks no one knows where he is. Oh, isn't he cute? Oh, little naive, innocent fellow. That's so pathetic. Oh, dear.
Somebody on the IRC said, people love social networks but don't like their neighbors. And it's like, yeah, so, you know, we don't always like everyone. Hey.
I just watched, I think you probably, many of you have seen this, I just saw, got a screener of Vondi's movie, We Live in Public, about Josh Harris, and yeah. Which raises some really interesting questions about privacy and so forth. And Josh's opinion was, everybody's going to live in public, you know. You'll be lucky to have 15 minutes of obscurity, not 15 minutes of fame.
That's actually really good.
Yeah, that is a good
my
line.
15 minutes of obscurity.
I just want 15 minutes of privacy. That's all I ask.
Well, you had your 15 minutes of obscurity, but it's already happened in the past.
It's
you
too late.
Back. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. You've already used up your 15 minutes. Too late. No, I actually think the really interesting piece about this is that before, the contours of privacy and public and semi-public or semi-private were much more evenly spread out. You had private, right? You could go into your house, you could really be private, go into the bathroom, you know, and you had these layers of privacy. And because right. you had physical architectures that supported those layers, you could see where you were and who could see you. And if you yelled really loud in the bathroom or cried, you know, the person in the living room might hear you, right? But you kind of knew. You had a sense of that. And then if you went outside your front door, the neighbors could see you. And if you went to school, everyone at school could see you. If you went to work, same thing, blah, blah, blah. And then, you know, we had really public stuff, which is like, maybe you got written up in the New York Times and now millions of people could see you. Right. And they knew something about you. But the contours and the barriers in the analog world were, you know, pretty easy to see. And now, of course, online, we have this really different thing. And I think what's collapsed is the in-between place for privacy, where when you went out your front door, just your neighbors could see you. So now the line is you're inside and away from a computer and no one can see you, or you're near a computer and somehow putting out some kind of an expression, right? Even a tweet or even just like the most basic, like an IM just with one other friend. But, you know, that friend could like cut and paste your whole IM, stick it in a website somewhere on a blog post, and now it's all public. And because it's really easy. And so we've collapsed the middle area where there was semi-private, semi-public.
Right.
And we've pushed all that to public. But it's not that everything is public.
I can still go to the bathroom.
You can still go to the bathroom and no one's going to know.
The NSA will know I'm there, but they can't.
Well, they'll know you're at your house, but they're not going to know probably where
Which
in your
part
house,
of the house.
Because GPS is actually unbelievably unreliable. I mean, the whole thing where people want to do like coupons when you walk past a store, and they're like, well, if you're in front of this store, you're going to get that coupon. But if you walk 10 more feet in front of a different store, you're going to get a different coupon. It's not very reliable. It's not that reliable. It's not that speedy. It's
And this, spe- you know, this spoken is somebody who's trying to develop this kind of software.
I've worked on it, and it's just, yeah, so the dream, as it were, you know, to do this is not,
What about augmented reality? We've now seen, you've got some augmented reality apps on the G1 or the the Google phone, and Apple has a couple. I just got a Yelp update that if I shake my phone three times, click my heels, and say there's no place like home, this new Yelp update on the iPhone, I can hold it up and it'll say, and point it, and it'll say, oh, yeah, right there, that's that. Oh, yeah, that's that. This is the review. That's pretty cool. But that's a compass, right? That's not...
That's a compass, and it's also just using the gyroscope to figure out when you're moving.
Oh, so it's,
right.
It's not that
There is actually also a thing that you can do with an altimeter. So one of the other pieces of software that Ed, who is my coder, worked on this spring was a flight planning software. And actually, when we go on a plane together, he'll pull out his software, and you're allowed to use GPS apps on an airplane on commercial flight. Yes, you are. And you can track yourself using Google Maps.
But I have to turn off the device.
You have to turn off the phone part. You're not allowed to connect with phone cell towers.
So the radio
GPS doesn't transmit.
GPS is just a satellite, so you're allowed to do that. So we pull out our phones, and we can track where like all the airports teeny ones, and where the plane has a little icon on the map, and we follow, like we'll fly somewhere, and you know.
I'd love an augmented reality, because I always look out the window and say, "What am I looking at?" If I could see what I'm looking at, that'd be really neat.
This shows you that it happens to be designed for people who are pilots,
right?
But it actually would be really cool for anyone just in an airplane to see where you are.
I was wondering about that. I thought it'd be really neat to have my GPS on, but I thought, well, that's probably not allowed. Okay.
But the thing about it is that it uses the altimeter piece, and it uses the gyroscope, and it uses the compass. And so it actually can, you wouldn't want to fly with it. Like if you relied on it, you probably would die.
Yeah.
But it is really fun.
That mountain isn't as close as it looks.
But it's very fun to take in the plane. Ed has a plane, so we use it in the plane, and it's really fun.
Oh, I'll have to do that next time I fly.
We should actually send it to Doug, because he has got a plane.
He's a pilot. You know, Doug's a pilot.
It's fun to play around with. You know, get an Android phone, Doug, and we'll send it to you.
Oh, that would be fun. I have GPS in the plane. It's amazing. I mean, it's completely revolutionized aviation navigation.
And, oh, yeah.
You know, totally. I mean, when you can see which side of the runway center line you're on based on GPS, you know it's pretty scary.
Yeah. Oh, that's awesome.
Brown University outsourcing its email to Google. This is I think a lot of universities are starting to do this because, you know, students got tired of the 10 megabyte limit on their mailbox.
Yeah. You know, I thought a listener sent this story to me, and I thought it was kind of a big deal because I just didn't know a whole lot about Google Apps for Education. It turns out that lots of universities already use it. But the part about that story that I thought was really interesting is that Brown students, 60% of them, they ran some stats, 60% of them already forward their university email to Gmail.
Wow.
Which is kind of huge. I mean, it really sort of, Gmail's really won the hearts and minds of not only the tech savvy, but young people. And I was talking about this with my wife, who's at UC San Diego, and I was like, isn't that a big number? And she was like, not at all.
It seems small almost.
I get students is either, you know, on behalf of so-and-so from Gmail or just a Gmail account to begin with. So I guess they're testing it out with 200 students and going to see how it goes, get feedback, and then roll it out. But there are quite a few universities that already use it, but not including Stanford, which I guess I saw I was researching this, and a TechCrunch reported in 2008 that they went with Zimbra, which I thought was surprising since the Google-Stanford kind of connection. But so... Yeah.
We have Google for Education, whatever it's called. We have that as our corporate mail corporate stuff because we're a nonprofit, so we get it for free also.
So I don't know why anybody would use Exchange at this point. I really don't.
You need a server. Why would you want to have a server? I mean, we want to be in the cloud, don't we?
Yeah.
You know, the only thing that I would say about that is that I've got friends who run companies where they're, you know, they'll have like 40,000 employees or 10,000 employees or whatever. And so I have one friend, he's a CEO, he has a company with 10,000 people. And he contacted Google a year ago about using Gmail and Google Apps generally. And they, you know, because they're a big enough company, they wanted certain things. And basically, Google just can't give support they couldn't really support them in a corporate circumstance. But conversely, I really think that the school application of Gmail, you know, the school use of that is just perfect. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's great. Schools don't have the money to put into that. And frankly, to have an IT department to support it sucks, right? So the idea that you could just, you know, outsource all of that stuff to Google is great. But I can see how corporations would not want to do it because they want more stuff, you know, and they can't afford to pay an IT guy to do it.
Right.
You know, so.
Well, and there's hosted Exchange, which is kind of the best of both worlds from their point of view.
Yeah.
They get exchanged, but they don't have to run the server themselves.
Yeah, but also I think if you look at the demographics of a student body, they're much more likely to be self-supporting. I think Mary's right. The corporate overhead from supporting that is something that the IT guy is saying, look, we've got to support Exchange or we've got to support Office anyway. We're going to stick to that.
I was thinking of using a Google Groups for a group that I am a part of at the school my kid goes to, and I was worried about privacy issues. Do you think that's a part of it? Do you think
you're talking about Google Groups? You're talking about
well, I'm talking about group. Yeah, groups, not
the
news
mailing
groups.
Lists.
Yeah, not news okay. groups, but they call it Google Groups. But yeah, it's mailing lists. It's like a message board.
Right. No, we use groups too. But that's
is
separate.
There a privacy
that's separate
issue
from what we're talking?
I
about.
Understand.
Okay,
but same thing with same question for Google Mail in a school. Is there a privacy issue?
Well, there can be. I mean, we have about 20 different groups in Google Groups at Conversations Network, and some of them are private. You know, some of them are locked down, and some of them are
wide open. But I'm just saying that a corporation, or even maybe even more so, a school would be maybe concerned that using Google to host either email or groups or anything else might be a problem in terms of privacy. At least with the Exchange server that you run, you know where that data is going.
I think
in terms of like revealing identity or
yeah, I don't know. I mean, here's a third party. I'm trusting a third party with this data. No, that's not a problem.
I don't think that's a big issue.
I don't think so.
Am I being innocent and naive again?
But endearing. I think the one of the bigger problems that a university has is shared computers. Where you know you log in.
That's you're right. I mean,
no, I mean that's
that's much more significant.
Much more significant, and that certainly is makes the Google Groups problem worse because you know you walk away from a computer, you've logged in, the cookie's there,
right?
And that's not so bad when you have a client app. Well, that's not true. I shouldn't say that. It's bad no matter what. But that's where the privacy issues are, I think, for most things like
that's schools. A much more significant issue than who's going through the data and
yeah.
who's storing it and so forth. Hey, let's get to our this is something that Doug and Mary, you can kind of sit back on if you want. Normally what Jeff, Gina, and I do is a tool of the week, a tip of the week, and a number of the week. Jeff's not here to do his number of the week. So, Gina, I guess it's you with the tip of the week.
Is this like Sesame Street?
You could do a number, the letter A, the number 7. Mary, if you want to come up with a stat, you can come up with a stat. I'll give you some time to think about it or a tip or anything. But you don't have to, is the point.
Okay.
You can take a bye on this one.
So my tip this week is Gmail related. They just launched a new contact chooser when you're composing email. So if you open up a new email in Gmail, you can now click the to label, the word TO next to the field to add recipients. And it'll pop up a small window which lets you search through your contacts and check off multiple recipients. And you can do this for your CC or BCC as well.
Oh, that's nice.
So just hit compose.
It's doing a lookup from the content from the contact database?
Yeah, it's basically a new interface to your contacts list, which is much needed. Gmail's contacts interface in general isn't one of the strongest parts of the app. But so you're looking at an email now, Leo. Yeah. If you hit the compose link.
Where is that?
left side of the contact.
Oh, yeah. You can see I use Gmail all the time. And,
and
I
then
start
if you click
typing.
The to field.
Okay. And then look at that. So it's got
Yeah, that's autocomplete. So you started type, okay. And that works well too. But
if I click
on the two,
this is what's new.
This is what's new. This is brand new.
And I like this most contacted thing. These are the people I've sent the most email to.
Yeah, that's a really smart and handy list as well. So you can search through your contacts. You can filter down by group, and then when you have a list of contacts, you can check them off as many as you need, and it'll add them to the to field. And then you hit the done button, and you're good. This has been up for a week now. I haven't used it a whole lot because I just tend to email specific people and use the autocomplete.
Right.
But it's really helpful if you send out a big message to several people, that you have in a group or. You know, that you just don't remember their email addresses or whatever their handles are.
I think you want to start paying attention to your Google contacts because it's getting more and more useful. For instance, because I categorized my contacts, I can have in Google Voice different voicemail messages. It actually threw my wife a little bit because she left a message. You know, she called my number and it said, "Hi, I'm not here right now. Leave a message. Love you." And she said, "Do you say love you to everybody who leaves a message?" And I said, "No, you're on my family list. You just didn't know that." And that's really cool. And then, you know, you can have an indefinite number of groups and have different responses for each of them. So, so start, and so that I noticed that shows up in the two too. I can search, I can categorize and search through them that way.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's great. I'm liking Google Contacts. It's basically now my contact database, and I sync it up with the iPhone and the Mac. The Pre did that automatically, which I thought was very cool. Of course, any Google phone would do that.
Oh, cool. Yeah, that's. I got serious about my Google Contacts with Google Voice.
Voice really, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. That really did it for me. I was like, okay, I'm gonna make groups, and I'm gonna make this work.
Yep. My thank you for the tip. Appreciate it. My tool of the week is something new added to a Google Reader that I think is very cool. Bundles have been a part of Google Reader for a while. In fact, our friend Kevin Marks made a comics bundle, which I subscribed to immediately. But this is that great browse for stuff section of Google Reader that you told us about, Gina, a couple of weeks ago. Has actually now got some stuff in it, which is pretty cool. So now they've got Power Reader bundles. And they've gone to a lot of big shots. There's different categories. There's news. There's technology. You can see who Arianna Huffington reads in her Google Reader. And not only see what her feeds are, but subscribe to them in a bundle. This is kind of Google's response in a way to OPML. I guess it's really kind of probably back-end is OPML. When you subscribe... You see, for instance, over here on the left, I've subscribed to Chris Anderson, the editor of Wired's bundle. It will actually be in a folder, so I can see what Chris Anderson is reading today, what Marcos is reading in the Daily Kos. I've got the Lifehacker group, which is the editor of Lifehacker, Paul Krugman's group. So you can subscribe. They've done a nice job, by the way, of finding conservatives as well as liberals. You've got Michelle Malkin as well as Paul Krugman. You don't have to feel too limited by that. But I think this bundles thing is kind of a neat way to kind of snoop on what people are reading and add them to your feed. A great way to find new feeds too. So all you have to do, it looks like I just broke it. That's interesting.
Just don't use it in the bathroom. People will know what you're reading.
Yeah, that's exactly right. So you can see these featured bundles created by Power Readers and then view all 27 of the bundles.
If you combine it with GPS, and I'll know where Paul Krugman was when he was reading.
Yeah, wouldn't that be cool?
Yeah.
The Lifehacker is Adam Pasch. Let's see, food and health, trends and fashion. I like this idea. I'd like to see more of these. So that's my my tool of the week. Of course, Google Reader has been a great tool as since we started the show. They've really done a lot of neat things to Google Reader, and this is one more nice little feature. Anybody want to add a number for our dear Jeff Jarvis, who's not here?
I didn't come up with a number
for Jeff. No stats. Uh-huh. Well, we can do our wine of the week. I'm sorry, Gina's so positive. She likes to call this our wish list. But I prefer to think of it as our bitch list.
Oh, I thought you were going to actually recommend wine.
Yeah.
I was like, okay, I'm totally there.
We've done that.
Oh, you know, Mary is who you want to talk to. Wine and food, Mary.
I have to say, Mary's recipes are, in fact, I tried to get Mary to come up here because I was hoping she'd bring an apricot tartin, but couldn't get her to do that. Yeah. So maybe next
apricots
time.
Apricots are out of season, but I could have brought nectarine.
We have peaches. We have
peaches
lots
are good.
Of peaches
we can
right
do peaches.
Now. I've got the
my
peach
new thing tree. Is making ice cream with liquid nitrogen.
I saw that on your blog. Mm.
Yeah, so we're bringing up a doer of liquid nitrogen to Burning Man this week,
and
I've got fig ice cream, nectarine, a chocolate one like dark chocolate, you know, a bunch of different things.
Here's your number of the week. How big is a doer?
It depends on the size. The one that we have is 10 liters.
A 10-liter doer.
And yeah. So that's about, you can make about 10 batches of ice cream with that, or gelato or sorbet or whatever it is that you want to make.
I've done it before. The nice thing about nitrogen ice cream is because it's so fast, it's very creamy. You don't get any crystals.
You don't get the crystals. And the thing about it is that when I made gelato, which is already a really reduced fat recipe compared to ice cream, it's still too fat. Like, they're so creamy that you can barely eat it. So what I ended up doing was cutting the fat to a quarter of the gelato one, which is a quarter of ice cream.
Wow.
So now, you have almost nothing in there. And so it's actually very healthy.
It's got that great creamy feel, the tongue feel.
Added bonus.
Yeah. Now, how do you get, okay, so when you have the fruit and stuff, you make your custard, your ice cream custard, and that's in a bowl. How do you get the fruit and the fillings in? Do you have them separate or you mix them in?
Well, so if you're going to, so for the fig thing that I just did, I just pureed very ripe Kadota figs, which are the green figs with like the pink insides. And they have them on sale right now at Whole Foods. And I just bought a ton and they were very ripe. And I pureed them with a little lime juice and sugar and a little bit of balsamic vinegar and some water. And then, and that's it. So that one's going to be a sorbet. I did one with nectarine, which has like a quarter. It has a half a cup of cream and like 6 or 8 cups, I think, of nectarines. And again, they were super ripe. Just pureed them. Little lime juice, little sugar, little bit of vanilla. That's it. You know, so very easy. So then, yeah, you just exactly like that. Yep, there we are. There,
she's pouring her doer in. So
the funniest thing is that it makes all this mist, so you actually can't really watch it happening. Nope. You're doing it all by touch.
you don't know what you're going to get. But so you pour the nitrogen in, and it's very, very cold. You've got a mixer, and of course you're wearing gloves, and don't try this at home, and your tongue will stick to it. No, I'm saying it to the other people.
Like,
Mary's a trained nitrogen professional.
That was only my first time. Those photos.
It's really fun.
It's really fun. Yeah. I totally recommend
it. Dr. Kiki did it on our TV show a couple of months ago. It was really fun.
All you have to do is liquid nitrogen. All you have to do that's really important is go to the web and read a couple of the guidelines. Like find somebody who's got, you know, guidelines about how to store it, how to manage it, how to do the gloves and stuff and wear goggles because you don't want it to splash in your eyes.
It could freeze your humerus.
Yeah, that would really be bad.
So, and Doug wanted to know, where do you get the nitrogen?
Oh, you can buy that from places like, I think Airgas is a company that is like kind of a chain of
so it's legal.
Places.
It's not restricted.
Oh, yeah. It's like $3 a liter or $2.25 or something like that. It's very reasonable.
And a liter will make a batch.
Leader will make a batch, and yeah, it's totally great. I mean, it's just easy and simple and very, it happens so fast. You put it in a bowl. You actually don't need the mixer. We've now determined, because it's our third time doing it.
You can do it with a spoon.
You can do it with a spoon. It takes like 30 seconds to a minute, and it makes puts all this air in the ice cream without ice crystals, and it tastes amazing.
So you don't, the custard, you don't make it any different way. You make it just like you were going to make ice cream.
Yeah. So the chocolate one has like a quart of milk, a half cup of cream, sugar, dark chocolate.
Simple.
Very, very simple. And egg yolks. You do your custard the way that you would get a recipe online. You know, do an ice cream recipe or a gelato recipe. Throw it, you know, refrigerate it. Like you always make ice cream, you always refrigerate the stuff.
Right.
Then you pour in your liquid nitrogen and it's great.
When I think of the hours I spent on the back step with rock salt cranking. I mean, literally hours cranking the ice cream maker. This is
no need. And it's super cool. You get to wear giant welding gloves and a mask. I mean, you know, you could wear a cape if you really want.
Done that for
it's not necessary.
I should have done that for Henry's birthday party. What was I thinking? Well, Mary, who needs a stat of the week? We've got liquid nitrogen.
Yes.
Mary Hotter is at napsterization.org/stories. We'll look forward to seeing what you're doing with this new mobile platform.
Thank you.
I think that's interesting. We'll look for it'll be on a Google phone, right?
Yes.
Android.
Along with we do want to do an iPhone version as well as BlackBerry, Palm Pre.
Cool.
That sort of thing. Maybe Windows Mobile.
And will help me lose weight and eat liquid nitrogen at the same time.
Yes.
Ice cream. Thank you, Mary. I'm so glad you called and could get on the show. This was wonderful.
Thanks.
Thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Gina Trapani's at smarterwear.org, which sounds like a place to get smarter underwear, but it is not. Although it wouldn't be a bad thing to have as like a sideline, like merchandising. You could do that.
Great to be here. This is a great show. Miss Jeff, but this was a fun show
today. Jeff will be back next week, I'm sure. Yeah, lots of fun. And thanks once again also to Doug Kay of the Conversations Network at conversationsnetwork.org. Anything you want to plug, Doug?
All the new work is at spokenword.org. It's our new, well, it's not new, but it's our project that will ultimately replace the podcast store on iTunes.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
It's about time.
Uh-huh.
Wow.
I'm ready to free us from the chains that bind us to Apple.
Yeah, we had a lot of people talk to us about that. We had a town hall meeting, and we realized that everybody hates the iPod store in iTunes.
You know who hates it most, at least in my opinion, is me. And it's only not, look, it was.
You're always there, Leo.
I said, did I not say when iTunes came along, this is the best thing that happened to podcasting and the worst thing.
You did say that.
It's great because it exposed it to a lot of people, but we've hit the ceiling. We hit the ceiling years ago because it's still too hard to figure out how to find a show, download it, get on your device, and listen to it. It's too many steps.
It's a closed system, and there are no APIs, and we're going to do an entirely open version of that.
Oh, that's great.
Anybody
news.
Can use.
Well, I look forward to seeing that. And we are working on a solution, too, that will... We did not want to release videos of all these shows, and we will be doing videos soon of all these shows, because we make video of all these shows. But I didn't want to release them on iTunes, because I didn't want it just to have it be another podcast. So we've got a new idea that is kind of related to something we were talking about earlier, and I'll leave that as an exercise for the listener. You can watch this show. We do it 2:15 Pacific time. That's 5:15 Eastern time every Saturday at live.twit.tv. And then, of course, subscribe on iTunes, and you'll be able to hear it at your leisure. Thank you, Mary Hodder. Thank you, Gina Terpani. Thank you, Doug Kay. I'm Leo Laporte. We'll see you next time on This Week in Google and Other Stuff.